Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. As a social media influencer based out of Columbus, this person has gained tens of thousands of followers for promoting fashionable style that leads to a philosophy of happy living. Jeanette Birchfield, also known as Jeanette Confetti on Instagram, wears bright colors and clothes that make her happy. And she thinks you should, too. For her, it's important to feel confident in yourself and take up space in the world. Welcome to the show, Jeanette.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Can you tell me, what kind of content do you create for your social media channel? I mean, it's colors, it's clothes, it's happiness. How do you summarize it?
Ooh, I would say it's basically, aside from colorful chaos, but it's therapy. Mm. It's very therapeutic to sometimes say something with fashion or decor or just something that makes you happy that you can't say with your own words. So sometimes you just have to let the clothes speak for you or the decor, the trinkets.
Well, you've been creating content for years, but what inspired you to start documenting your outfits?
When I noticed there weren't a lot of folks that looked like me represented in media, you know, you do have like a bunch of plus size content creators that wear like your everyday neutrals or you're just your straight up basics, which is fine. I love all clothes and all fashion, but there was there was a lack of like the color or it being produced in sizes that people of size can wear. So when I found it, I focused on showing everybody where they could find it too and what it looked like on my body.
Right, right. And you're known for your vibrant, bold outfits. Yes. Why do you think there's a lot of people out there who have trouble wearing bright clothes? What's the barrier there?
I feel like sometimes people often think that they want to hide or they don't want to bring so much attention to themselves. But I think that even wearing something bright could alter your mood or make somebody feel happy when they see you on the streets. So you never know what kind of, mood you're trying to set for the day.
Yeah, I was going to say what the vibe.
Exactly.
Yeah, you wake up with it. Yeah. Well, for our listeners who can't see, Jeanette's wearing a polka dotted dress and bright blue sweater that, you know, that's very fun. So I have a photo. I'm going to put a photo on the All Sides Instagram page later. That's at All Sides WOSU. And if you want to learn more about Jeanette, we want to tell people how to find you. So you're Jeanette Confetti on Instagram, and that's Jeanette with two N's and then a Y, and Confetti with an I. Am I saying
yes,
that? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you want to spell it for me?
Ooh. So it's going to be JeAnnetteY and then Confetti, CON. FETTII, and then one I on TikTok.
Okay, got it. Yes. Oh, all those little social media things you have to deal with, but you're dealing with it well.
Thank you.
You have quite the number of followers on all the platforms. What do you think of that? Like as your following grew, like once you hit 10,000, 20,000, upwards of 50,000 more, and then you hit more than that, you were like, wait a second, what's happening? what did that make you feel like?
It makes me feel pretty it's awesome to realize that you're able to be representation no matter to how many people. Mm-hmm. It could be one person that, you know, sees themselves in me online and showing up. So I just think that's so important to be able to, especially in the world we live in right now, to just spread a little joy and be able to relate and see somebody that you can Yeah, what just relate See, to? Excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah. So you're a local creator. Can you tell us about what keeps you rooted here in Columbus? I mean, tell me about you and this city.
Oh, man, I love Columbus so much. So Columbus is just such a dynamic city, and I will always use dynamic as a describer for us because we are so fast growing. There's so much here. Coming back to Columbus, I lived in California for a little bit, and it's just like, it's like a love song. It's a hug. You know, people here are different. It's a community. All the creatives here, we're like a basic, we're like a little family. We have a lot of different groups, but like when we all come together, it's amazing. So a lot of cities don't have that. And I just think Columbus is very special. There's so much to do. I know a lot of people talk down on us, but we are the best.
Now, as an advocate for plus size fashion, you mentioned this already, but like, what steps do you think should be taken by brands to promote inclusivity? Like, what do you, if you had a magic wand, what do you wish?
I just wish that some brands will not consider us as an afterthought when thinking of clothes. Like, we want to look cute in every like size. And just feel comfortable in the clothing that is available to us. We shouldn't have to go on a scavenger hunt to look for something that will fit us and will look cute. We need to be dressed. We have things to go to. And sometimes it's not going to just be something that you find at Elaine Bryant or ready off the rack. We want to look fabulous all the time. And we're not a second thought.
Is Jannetty Confetti still a side hustle for you, or have you been able to transition into doing this more full time?
Ooh, so I work 7 days a week.
Okay.
So I don't, all the things that I do full fledged and full heartedly. So it's not, I think Jannetty Confetti will be a side hustle. It will always be a side hustle. Excuse me.
I see. Yeah. but you like to, so I introduced you as an influencer.
Yes.
You know, and we wrote you're a fashion influencer. That's the title we gave you. But you like to call yourself more of a community organizer. Why do you prefer that description?
Because there's so much more to, you know, influencing. And I feel like we're all influencers, right? I get influenced by my sisters all the time to buy stuff. I think being a community organizer, being in Columbus and being with your other creative friends, I'm a huge advocate for the arts. I work in the arts industry as well. I work with Opera Columbus. And I just think that it's important to build up the communities that you're also taking, you know, and influencing in, because we have to lift up these organizations that, you know, can so easily be taken from us.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with fashion influencer, also known as community organizer, Jannette Birchfield, and she is also known online as Jannetty Confetti. There's another word. There's other words for influencer. There's a trendsetter. There's a social media celebrity. Do you like any of those other words, or you want to go with community organizer?
I like community organizer. Again, like sometimes even like meeting people in other markets, like influencers can be sometimes have like a one mind or one track. They want stuff. They want to be in these rooms so they can see what else they can get. And I just want to benefit or want other things to benefit other organizations, other spaces, businesses. I want to lift up the community, and I want to bring people together, importantly, even if it has to be with just some colorful confetti or polka dots.
So what you wear, though, it doesn't only affect how you look on the outside. It does impact how you feel internally. Can you talk to me about how clothing can be therapy?
So sometimes it's hard to get dressed. I know that a lot of people had a hard time, especially during the pandemic, to just even put on clothes besides pajamas. And I think that's when I really started diving into, you know, wearing more and more maximalist dopamine, because we were all going through something. And I just thought it was very important to be able to look at myself in the mirror and say, hey, wow, that's amazing. And this is putting a smile on my face. Imagine how many other smiles you can put on people's faces. So,
yeah. And how does the color of your outfits bleed into other aspects of your life? You know, I can imagine that your clothes literally and figuratively take you places.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it just bleeds all over. I could tell you about a few times when folks have said, "Oh my gosh, I saw something and I thought of you." Mm. And I'm like, "Wow, that's the nicest thing somebody could ever say," because, you know, I'm everywhere.
Mm.
So even in my home, it's very colorful. It's not perfect, but it's perfect for me. And even just, I call it confetti core.
Oh, okay. What does that mean?
It just basically means like, it's just like if you see something like this, or like maybe like rainbow, pastel, vibrant, it's going to be Jeanette confetti core. So,
oh, okay. like your canon, core canon.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly.
So if you see rainbows, you see sprinkles, you see sparkles, we
you
should think
me.
Of you.
Yes.
Got it. I got it. So you have noted that there's responsibility that comes with being a community organizer / influencer. Tell me about using your platform for positivity.
Yes. So like I said, I'm a huge advocate for community and bringing folks together and body inclusivity. So I just think it's so important to not, you know, stay quiet, especially during times when we're trying to be pushed underneath the rug. Just showing up and being a decent person it's not hard. And I just want to always strive to be that, and somebody that can be relied on in these times. So
now, social media can be a very positive place. Mm. You're a source for the positivity, but it can also be a very negative environment for creators. Have you had interactions with, we'll call them internet trolls, and how, I'm sure you have. How have you dealt with it?
Wow. So I know some social media platforms are pretty quick to let you block like all of the negative like buzzwords, emojis. I do have that active on some of them, but you know, at the end of the day, I just let my following.
Oh, they take care of it for you.
They do. I don't have to say anything sometimes, and sometimes I'll even pin like any negative comment because I'm like, here's the attention you wanted. Now. So you have
pointed people out, because they're not all bots. I mean, there's
no.
humans behind these sometimes.
Yeah, miserable folks.
Right. And so do you feel like maybe pointing it out to them, you know, like you're getting noticed, that here's exactly what you want. Now what?
Yeah, absolutely. And I had one person like literally inbox me and said, "I'm so sorry for what I said."
Oh.
And I said, "Okay.
Okay. You helped with some growth there."
Exactly. We love growth.
Hopefully they don't do it again then.
Yeah, we'll see.
It's like think twice, post once.
Right. That's the best the whole part.
How has being a community organizer, a fashion influencer, a social media star, how has it changed your life?
Wow. I would say the people that I just get to meet and connect with. I think connection is so important. And being able to just grow and learn from all the folks that I meet, and just being in spaces like this and being able to talk about the things I love and how to have more representation like me in these spaces. It's just amazing. And I think there's more to come. This is just like the forefront. And I say that every year because there's always an opportunity for something else great to happen. So I'm just looking forward to it.
Yeah, I was wondering about expansion. Are you building a brand around yourself?
I feel like this is the brand.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always open.
Well, I was thinking clothing line, your own clothing.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean, always looking for that. But I really, really have a dream to do like an eyewear, like some frames, something cool and funky.
Oh, yes. Listeners, when you look at her picture later on Instagram or Facebook for the All Sides page, you will see her fabulous glasses. Yes. Would you recommend this type of career to someone else? Because I have done shows about how every teenager thinks they're going to become famous online. Would you caution them away from that? Or are you more in the camp of telling them to go for it?
I feel like do what feels right. I think there's a lot of benefits of doing something like this. And it's some people I know, they've done it to get out of their shell and be able to like come out of themselves and share what they were feeling. Or it's like it's a creative space. So people can take whatever they want from it. it can get out of control, but I absolutely encourage folks to do something creative.
Whether or not they make $1 million doing
it. Exactly, because it's not going to, it's not always going to be a viral moment. And I feel like you're capitalizing on the family and the community. You're already organizing your spaces for you. So sometimes it's not about the numbers. It's not about how many people are seeing it, because, again, one person can see it and take a lot from it. So
have you had, I'm sure you've had more than one viral moment.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. What's your biggest, you know?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I would say the food stools that I'm a fashion or a Maxinista, and I love Home Goods. So I call Home Goods, TJ Maxx, and Marshalls the cousins.
Okay.
So I went around for a while looking for these food stools that are like shaped like fruit. Our food fruits.
Literally a stool that looks like fruit.
Literally.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have a few of them, and I would like go on these adventures looking for them and find them. So I did a compilation of all of the ones that I have, and people loved that. So that's my biggest one.
People love Home Goods. Yeah, you know.
So good.
So good. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. It's been lovely to meet you and talk with you. And we have been talking with community organizer, fashion influencer, social media star, Columbus's own Jeanette Birchfield, also known as Jeanette Confetti. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk with the owners of many restaurants, including the Eagle, Bakersfield, and more. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. If you've ever been to the Short North, then chances are you've passed by both the Eagle, a casual American restaurant and bar, and Bakersfield, known for its tacos and tequila. Both spots happen to be owned by Thunderdome Restaurant Group, whose name is nearly as vibrant as the atmospheres of their businesses. With 9 different restaurants and chains under their belts, this Cincinnati-born company is bringing food and memories to people all over the Midwest. And joining us to discuss are John and Joe Lanny, the co-owners of Thunderdome. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Appreciate you having us here today. Thank you.
Yeah, great. So we'll have to have, so we can figure out who's John and who's Joe. John, let's start with you. Can you tell me what got you started in the restaurant business?
Thank you again for having us. Yes, this is John.
Okay.
We grew up around the restaurant business, so it's been kind of in our blood since we were born. Our father was in the business. He had a chain of restaurants called Great Steak and Potato Company. They were a lot of mall food courts. Based, the first one was in Dayton, Ohio, in 1982. And so Joe and I grew up going to shopping centers and mall food courts around the country, and being a secret shopper for dad and checking out stores. So I think it was just something that we always felt we would do. We grew up in Hamilton, Ohio. So about 45 minutes north of Cincinnati, and about 15 minutes from Miami of Ohio and Oxford.
Well, and then Joe, your brothers, did you always plan to work this closely together? Was that a part of the plan?
Yeah, I don't think we ever thought we'd do anything else. Part of to add John's story there my father and his brother were working together to create that company. And so that dynamic just seemed pretty natural to us. And, I think for a portion of our lives, we thought we'd probably be going out, getting some experience, and then coming back to the family business. It turned out that as malls kind of went through their different stages, they really rode the wave of the expansion of the major regional enclosed shopping center. And in the early 2000s, it was just starting to kind of contract a bit, and a buyer came along. And as only someone who is on the front lines of their business every day could realize, the future wasn't looking great for malls, and Dad realized that. And we made the tough decision as a family that he should sell to this buyer, and he did. And when that happened, John and I were out getting experience. I was in Boston working for Uno Chicago Grill doing the real estate and development work. John was in Chicago working for Let Us Entertain You in an operations capacity. And we just decided we always thought we were going to work together, might as well move back to Cincinnati and see if we could put something together. That's what we did.
Can you tell me, John, can you tell me how Thunderdome got its name?
Thunderdome, well, even going back to when we first started, Querido actually was our first concept. We had nine concepts in the 50-plus restaurants around the country, but we're mainly regionally focused in the Midwest. We're based in Cincinnati. I'd say we're the second largest independent restaurant group in the state of Ohio behind your hometown guy, Cameron Mitchell. So, yeah. And the name Thunderdome really came out of just as you kind of mentioned in your intro, Bakersfield and Eagle are pretty lively restaurants, and they're fun places to be. And our first Bakersfield was in Cincinnati, and it was a lively place. But the neighbors upstairs were having a little bit of trouble with the noise. So we had a meeting with our landlord, and long story short, we had a meeting about sound mitigation with our landlord. But our landlord was also looking at a second location that we were all excited to do. And that location actually happened to be the Eagle in Over the Rhine as well. So that was the second location behind Bakersfield. And Joe just made a kind of a funny comment about it being a fireworks and motocross themed, restaurant called the Thunderdome. And we were just laughing about it. And then on the way back to the office, we said, "Oh, Thunderdome, that's a pretty cool name. Maybe we should just embrace that and use it for, our group name." And at that time, we had just opened Bakersfield. We had Curio. We had one other concept called Soli. So we really were forming this sort of multi-concept restaurant group. And it felt appropriate at that time to go ahead and kind of officially give us a restaurant group name.
Yeah, I think it was just an offhand joke, but it really it does speak to the core of what we do, which is throw the party every day for our guests and our team. So just seemed like a fit.
All right. And just you two, you sound kind of echoey in the room. So I'm going to just quickly do a reset here. And I think we're going to try to call you on a cell phone just to help with the audio a little bit so we can understand you better. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we are talking about the Thunderdome Restaurant Group with co-owners John and Joe Lonnie. And they have a lot of restaurants. They have nine different concepts and chains, nine different restaurant chains and restaurants under their belts. It's a Cincinnati-born company, and it's bringing food and memories to people all over the Midwest. They have both the Eagle, Bakersfield, and many other names in their group, which is the Thunderdome Restaurant Company. And do we have you back with us? Can you hear us? Oh, nope, that didn't work. Okay. Well, I guess we can continue to try through the Zoom. Do either of you have a favorite restaurant in your group? I don't want to make you pick a favorite child, but what's your favorite restaurant?
you kind of are making us pick a favorite child.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of people say that their favorite is their first, or you know, mm-hmm. So maybe favorite's a strong word, but can you tell me like which restaurant, you know, just makes you happy when you're sitting there eating the most?
Absolutely. I would say, well, we love all of them. You know, Bakersfield and the Eagle, you know, they really were the two that kind of helped us grow, get into different markets you know, they're the core of our business, the biggest part of our business right now. And so, you know, while I won't pick one, I'll say those two are, you know, very special to us.
Can you tell us how you ended up with so many different types of restaurants? I mean, you could have gone, you know, all tacos and done in a big expansion with all Bakersfield, but why did you decide to have such variety?
You know, I think the different concepts really were part of just, we didn't start out saying we want to have a multi-concept restaurant group. It was really more about the entrepreneurial spirit and wanting to bring certain things to our home market here in Cincinnati, and then, you know, testing them and seeing how they do, and when they were a success, something's maybe right for scaling, we take them to other cities. And so, you know, we go ahead.
Yeah, it was really just opportunity driven. It was there were certain opportunities that came up, particularly in the Over the Rhine district, you know, in Cincinnati. And when those opportunities came about in all of these cities, right? Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland, and Indianapolis, Detroit, they all saw an urban renaissance of sorts. In the 2010s, I'd say, you know, even from like 2005 to 2020, you really saw the downtown core grow in a meaningful way. You know, Short North is just a tremendous example of that. We absolutely love the Short North. And when those opportunities started to come about, we took them. And a large part of our growth, a large part of the growth of Thunderdome, was in these urban core settings.
So there's a concept you have called Pep and Dolores, and specifically that one has received many awards, including just a few months ago, that restaurant was recognized as the 10th best restaurant in the U.S. from Yelp's top 100 restaurant list. I mean, that's a huge recognition. What is that? How does that make you feel?
Amazing. You know, that restaurant is named after our grandparents. You know, it was really born out of, it was a passion project for the two of us. We're first generation Italian Americans. Our father and his parents and one of his brothers came over on a boat from Italy. And, you know, we've always felt that he was the embodiment of the American dream. And so to be able to open a restaurant named after our grandparents, and you know, prominently featuring real family photographs in one of the portions of the restaurant, and you know, to think about the hospitality we felt when we went to visit our grandparents, and the food being central to the experience, that one just came together beautifully. We've got an amazing team there, and couldn't be more honored to be receiving accolades like that. It was also it's been an open table, top 100 restaurant in the country 5 years in a row, which is also just unbelievable to us. And
wow. Now, if I'm remembering correctly, that one only has one location, though. Is that correct?
It does have one location, although we just announced today that we're opening a second location and an Eagle here in Cincinnati next to one another. This year, later this year, should open around, you know, September of this year.
So, oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's great. So you are, because I was going to ask you if Pep and Dolores was going to remain, you know, just like stay as one, or if you're going to make a chain, you know, like you do with all the others. So there's my answer. Is that always a part of the plan? Like each restaurant you want to duplicate?
No, you know, this one very well may have stayed one restaurant, and that would have been great. But we had a, again, back to opportunity, we had a great opportunity, a great development up in the kind of Deerfield Mason area here, and just decided it was the right time to pull the trigger on number two.
Do you have any plans to expand beyond the Midwest? Because I was looking up the names of the cities. You know, you're in Ohio. You mentioned Detroit in Pittsburgh. Are you going to go bigger than that?
There's different, I think, approaches for different concepts. We also, two of our concepts we sell franchises for, and that is Credo and Citybird. And those are more on the fast casual side of things. They're more quick service. And for those particular concepts and franchising, I think we'd go well beyond the Midwest. And we actually have some Credo locations along the East Coast and in Florida. We are actively looking, just as a shameless plug, we're actively looking for a Querido franchisee in Columbus for sure. But in terms of the other sort of corporate growth, again, I don't want to say that we would never do that. We would, you know, we wouldn't put an Eagle or a Bakersfield down in Florida or out west or somewhere like that. But it just hasn't come about yet. And you know, the more markets you're in, the obviously the tougher it is to manage, right? Building teams around certain markets and cities, and the more you expand, it just becomes exponentially harder. So over nine concepts and over several different markets, the business just gets more and more complex. And so we probably are really looking to backfill some of the markets that we're currently in right now.
We've been talking about the Thunderdome Restaurant Group with co-owners John and Joe Lonnie. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate the time.
Yeah, it's great being here. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to learn about signs at the American Sign Museum. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Signs reflect a certain time and culture. Iconic light bulb and neon signs are pivotal elements of the 20th century Americana aesthetic. Some signs, such as the Hollywood sign in Los Angeles, are national landmarks. The American Sign Museum, located in Cincinnati, is a museum dedicated to preserving, archiving, and displaying historical signs. The museum is celebrating its 25th anniversary and putting out a coffee table book to celebrate. And today we're talking with David Dupuy, the museum's director. Welcome to All Sides, David.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Can you tell us a bit about the mission of the American Sign Museum?
Sure, yeah. Our mission is to celebrate the wonderful and rich history of American signage through education and preservation.
So part of the mission is preserving these signs. So that means you have to, like, find them and you know, make them look nice so you can put them on display. But tell me about the preservation part. Why is it important to, you know, have these, preserve these, show them to others?
Yeah, it... You know, preservation is a pillar of our mission, and these signs are such they're not just historical artifacts. I mean, they're rich in with nostalgia and memory for so many folks. For instance, we just got a Frisch's, which is a big restaurant with a history here in Cincinnati that goes back to the 1930s, and you have so many memories over decades associated with the sign. So when it comes into our collection, we have a responsibility to maintain it in a way that is historically accurate and allows folks to enter into kind of a trip down memory lane as they recall meals at this place. So preservation is critical to what we do here.
Where do you find the signs? Like that one you just gave an example of, a big boy sign from the 1930s. Did someone have it and in their garage or what?
Yeah, sometimes that's the case. Our founder, Todd Swarmsted, started in 1999. And when he started, it really was a lot of donations, word of mouth, purchasing signs. Now we're at the point where a lot of people have heard of us. And so, like, for instance, we have a marquee, theater marquee from Exeter, New Hampshire. And there it was getting taken down, and the community wanted to preserve it. And they were aware of us as a perfect destination for that place to go. So we have a lot of people reach out to us now with historic signs that they would like to see live on. So yeah, most of it is through donation.
Now, some signs can be pretty big. Do you have to display maybe pictures of them instead of displaying every sign? Or do you, I know you expanded and got bigger. Do you have enough space?
Yeah, we doubled our footprint just a little over a year ago, added 20,000 square feet, which is an expansion of our Main Street experience where a lot of our bigger signs are located. We're fortunate to have filled most of that space. So we are running out of a little bit of space, but the nice thing about our warehouse building, it's a 100-year-old building with very tall ceilings. So we're able to accommodate most of the larger signs, which creates a really, really cool experience for guests.
Now, I know that you have, I guess, 100 years worth of signage. Talk to me about how a sign can reflect a piece of American history. Like it's kind of like a moment in time. Like it shows what was the popular font, the popular colors, right? Tell me more about that history.
Yeah, it really covers a lot, and so. You know, whether you're into the history of advertising and branding, like this is a moment in time of font or particular brand styles. That's intriguing. It also reflects the craftsmanship. So there's stories behind the signs about each individual, whether it's a sign painter or a neon vendor, the techniques that are used to make the sign. But then the other story behind the sign is the entrepreneur itself. All these signs are basically built on the hopes and dreams of entrepreneurs who took a risk to literally hang up a sign. And signs often the last thing that happens in a Main Street business. And it's the thing that you celebrate. You're officially opening your doors. So there's a lot of history behind these businesses that we also like to celebrate.
Yeah, a funny thing about signs is in the neighborhood I live in, I always get excited when a business puts a sign up because then that means they're going to stick around for a while, or at least they plan to stick around for a while. I live in an area of town where businesses come in and out, you know, after 1 year if they're not successful. And I, if they put up a sign, I'm always like, yes, they're giving it a go. They're going to try.
Exactly. Yeah, they're making the investment, and that is the kind of the last step. There's no turning back. I was in the brewery business before this, and we opened a few locations. And the proudest moment was when that sign went up. I mean, you're planting your flag in the community, saying we're here, we're not going anywhere, and we want to be a staple of this particular community. So there's really a lot of placemaking that goes into signage.
And I know you mentioned your founder a few minutes ago. Is that how did the American Sign Museum end up in Cincinnati? Is Cincinnati known for its skyline chili and its signs?
Yeah, right. Well, we're known as being a bit of a branding capital with P&G here. So there's a lot of history with advertising and branding. But the story of our particular, the origin story for the museum was Todd Swarmsted, family started the Signs of the Times magazine, which is kind of the premier go-to publication within the sign industry. So Todd was in that world, and as he described it, had a midlife crisis in his 40s and wanted to start kind of an entrepreneurial project that's adjacent to the family's experience. So started to work on a plan for a museum. Initially in 1999, I was in the Mount excuse me, the Walnut Hills neighborhood here in Cincinnati. And then it just grew to the point where it needed more space. And so now we're in a 40,000 square foot facility here in Camp Washington.
Neon signs are an iconic piece of American culture. Iconic diners, theaters. Everyone can picture a vintage neon sign, I think. Can you talk about how neon is like demonstrated or like, you know, plays a role in the museum? And how do you keep all these neon signs working, I guess?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I think what makes our museum unique is there is an immersive component because we have Neon Works, which is the only neon shop within probably 100-mile radius of Cincinnati. This is kind of a bit of a lost art form these days as LED has kind of taken over. So we have a sign shop here that repairs all of our signs, and then we also do custom work for customers and other businesses. But I mentioned that one of our pillars of our mission is education. And so every Saturday we have two neon demonstrations where our neon benders will kind of walk through the process and actually bend a tube for guests. So it's a really fascinating way to get exposure to this lost art form and see how neon was made and is continued to be made.
A neon bender. That is a job I didn't know existed. Can you tell me a little more about it? I don't even know what to ask, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of term for an artisan creating neon signs or tubes. So we call them benders. They're taking glass and kind of first step is bending it and bending it in the fire. So it's manipulating the glass through that heat. And then adding gas to the tube, and it will eventually light up. But it's a very, you know, meticulous, thoughtful art form that sure, it's certainly a little bit, it's more expensive than LEDs, but we like to think that it really stands the test of time and stands out both from a marketing and just this aesthetic standpoint, more so than LED. Mm-hmm.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the American Sign Museum with David Dupuy, the museum's director. The museum is about to release a coffee table book celebrating its 25th anniversary, which includes the history of the museum, notable signs. Can you talk about the book? What made you decide, you know, that you wanted to show this to other people via this book?
Yeah, we had a record year last year with over 80,000 visitors, and we were named the number three pop culture museum in the country by USA Today. So it was a really big year, but wanted to not forget where we had come from. And since it was our 25th anniversary, we thought it was a perfect time to kind of document how we got to this point, in particular, the steps that Todd has taken and all the people that have supported him along the way. So it's a great, it's our story, but I think it's also a visual history of signage over the years. And more perhaps to the point, it's a history of Americana. And it's really a unique book that I think has resonated with so many of our guests.
Let's talk about you for a few minutes. You were named the museum's executive director about 2 years ago. Did you have a background in museums or signs? Like, how did you end up with this job?
Yeah, it's a great question. As I told the board when I was interviewing, you know, I really enjoy going to museums. And that's been the case. I taught social studies for a couple years before I, you know, went to law school and then practice law for a little bit, but come from a family of small business owners. I wanted to start something. So I ended up starting a brewery in Milwaukee with a business partner. But I've been from Cincinnati and my kids were getting older. We wanted to get closer to family. So we moved back and was able to step into this role, which to me is a perfect marriage of my interests, which is I love history, but also Main Street businesses. And I think our museum is many things, but one thing it is for certain is a celebration of Main Street business. And I'm a passionate believer that Main Street business is kind of is the backbone of our economy. So it was a really great fit for me. And I'm very grateful to the board for the opportunity.
Yeah. Well, so I'm hearing social studies teacher turned lawyer turned craft brewery owner turned museum director. So that's kind of a unique path to travel there.
Yeah, it's not a straight line. So, but it's been fun, and you know, we've got a great team here that's super passionate about the mission, what we're trying to do. And it's a lot of fun to come work every day. So really grateful for it.
So I'm sure whenever you interviewed and then got the job, you had to set some goals for the museum. Were the goals this expansion, the coffee table book, getting more people in the door? We talk about some goals for the future of the museum.
Yeah, so when I came on board, we were probably less than about a month away from our grand opening of the expansion. So I came in at a really great time because the capital campaign had been completed. Most of the construction was completed as well. But what we didn't know was what a post-expansion would look like for the museum. And it's a really challenging time for museums right now. So we had to figure out, goal number one was to figure out what is our business model to make sure that we're, sustainable. And a year plus in after the expansion, I feel like we've found our footing there, which has allowed us then to kind of think a little bit more bigger picture about where we want to be in, 5 to 10 years. But yeah, the first year for me on the job was trying to set us up for success in this new expanded footprint. And now we get to think about, other projects we might want to pursue, and the book was one of those.
Are you open like regular museum hours? Like if someone from Columbus wants to drive down to Cincinnati, I'm sure I know they can look on your website for the hours, but are you like most museums where you peak on Saturdays and Sundays, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we're Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday is definitely our busiest day. That's also when we do free public tours and the neon demonstrations. So Saturday is a very busy day. We often on Saturdays also have kids programming. So Saturday is the busiest. Yeah, that Wednesday through Sunday are our core hours, and then we also do private events in the evenings.
And people like to have signs, as decorations, rather than a functional purpose. But what do you think draws people to signs as decorations? Because I know people who have, signs for their favorite restaurant or, a Coca-Cola sign hanging in their house. What draws people to a sign?
Yeah, I think it's different for different people. And it's interesting that the museum, everyone has, I think the one common denominator for people as far as their experience here is a wow factor. You walk in and just wow, taking in the bright lights and Americana. And our job as the museum is to help people go a little bit further, to build a connection with the collection and understand what's driving that wow for them. And I think for a lot of people, it is just general bucket of nostalgia. And I think that reflects itself in collectors and why certain signs people like. It brings back specific memories. And even if it's not a location, a sign of a location that a collector or individual went to, the type of artistry, in particular like a neon sign, evokes just a lot of nostalgia and feelings of the past. So I think that nostalgia is a very strong driver, and but there are other reasons as well.
Do you know which sign at the museum is the most popular? What do most people take their picture in front of?
So we have a couple Frisch's Big Boy signs that are quite popular. I mentioned the Frisch's Mainliner sign, just coming from the Fairfax neighborhood here in Cincinnati. That was so beloved, and when it was announced that it was closing, there's a big uproar over what was going to happen to the sign. And so the fact that we got it just garnered a lot of attention. And so typically, this is an interest. Typically, we talk about you mentioned re preservation earlier. Typically, when we get a sign, we would handle the preservation offsite and then bring the sign in. With this sign, we thought it was a great opportunity to do the restoration work in progress for our guests to be able to see it. So the restoration of the mainliner is in progress, and you can watch it any given day when you come in. So that's generated a lot of interest, and that's probably our most popular sign at the moment.
Do you have a favorite sign at the museum?
Yeah, I get asked that. I can answer that a couple different ways, but one that I'm probably most drawn to, and this is just an emotional connection, and an example of one I've never been to, is Johnny's Big Red Grill. It's out of Ithaca in New York, and It was a popular watering hole for Cornell students, and my grandpa went to Cornell. So even though I've never been to Ithaca, I just it evokes memories of my grandfather, which I really appreciate. So that sign to me has special meaning.
Okay, so I guess just to end on, what do you hope people take away from a visit to the American Sign Museum?
Yeah, I hope that there's a gained appreciation for how signs shape our culture. They're certainly important as far as wayfinding tools, but I think we take them for granted. Like they are ubiquitous, they are all over the place, and they help inform our everyday in ways I don't think we fully appreciate. And then when you look behind the signs, I hope that people gain an appreciation for the artistry that went into it, the craftsmanship over the years. And the stories of the business owners that took the risk to put them up in the first place.
We've been talking about the American Sign Museum with David Dupuy, the museum's director. Thank you so much for your time today, David.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
And you've been listening to Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show or any show, you can listen back at our website, wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast or listen to any episode in the WOSU mobile app. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.